This week in Retronauts, we're chilling like a villain. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts. This is episode 343.
Wow.
And we are getting near the end of 2020 and 2021. No matter what happens, this is recorded in October, so many things about the future are a mystery that you will already have seen revealed to you by the time this episode airs. But we are declaring 2021 the year of Wario. And to kick it off, Nintendo's too cowardly to actually declare this themselves, so we're making it official. To kick it off, here is a prelude. We're talking about the Wario Land series, and we're kicking off with this episode, Wario Land 1 and Virtual Boy Wario Land, the two kind of outliers that people don't really talk about all that much. And it's going to be very exciting because they are very good games. And with me here on the line, I have very good games enjoyers, including a special guest who I don't think has been on Retronauts before. Introduce yourself and please elucidate your past with Retronauts, if it exists.
Hi there, I'm Kyle Orland, first time, long time. I'm real happy to be here. I've listened to Retronauts off and on for a long time, whenever an episode interest strikes my fancy. And really happy to talk about this great start to a series, really the first big spinoff to the Mario franchise, unless you count some of the weird non-platformer ones.
Like Mario Kart? That's a pretty strange word that no one cares about.
No,
but yes, Kyle is here because not only is he a renowned ombudsman, he's also the guy who kicked off a site called the Mushroom Kingdom, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
The other one, Super Mario the other one. Headquarters.
Ah, sorry.
Mushroom Kingdom was our hated rival.
Oh, God. Wow.
He was their Wario or vice versa.
Well, in any case, I have used your work as reference for many years when doing Wario-related research and Mario-related research and Toad-related research. So thank you for your hard work and service. And that is why we have asked you to be on this episode, because you know things of Mario and Wario and other characters.
Yes, thank you. Although I really don't think people should be going back to what I wrote at 15 years old on the 90s internet as any sort of reference material for anything except embarrassment.
Yeah. I'm very fortunate in that no one really had internet access when I was 15, so I am saved from that ignominy. But also, as often happens with Mario episodes, we have some regulars here. Introduce yourselves, guys on the West Coast.
Hey, it's Bob Mackey, and I am just full to the brim with garlic. And I did want to point out that we did a Wario Land episode almost 8 years ago. We covered the entire series because we still had gaming website PTSD, and we thought the axe was going to fall at any moment. So those earlier episodes are just stuff like, we got to cover every episode, every game in every series immediately. But then we realized, well,
wasn't that a micro episode, or am I mistaken?
Oh, no, that was episode 2. So
that was
a proper episode too. But then over time we learned, we could just do this forever and no one's going to fire us and take our equipment. So so I'm happy to come back to this after replaying these games again 8 years later. And I dare you to go back and just tell us how much younger we sound in 2013.
Right. I see people complain about Retronauts revisiting topics that we've covered before, but when we retrace our footsteps, when we backtrack in Metroidvania style, we cover these topics in so much greater depth and with so much more knowledge and experience at this point that, you know, it's like those older episodes are just kind of like a preview for the actual conversations we're having now. So I don't really get why people are like, Retronauts just repeating itself instead of talking about, like, I don't know, some dumbass game that only I care about. Sorry, it's a dumbass game that only you care about. And lots of people care about Wario, and we care enough about Wario that we want to talk some more about it. And that includes our other person who still hasn't introduced himself.
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert. I am wearing my dragon breathing baseball cap for this one.
I'm sitting right across from you. This is dangerous.
Garlic and dragon breath. It's a great combo out there.
I haven't hit the B button just yet. Don't worry. But I am a big fan of the Mario franchise for sure. I've read a lot of Super Mario Brothers HQ back in the day as well.
Yeah, I mean
and as a Mario super fan, I enjoyed the Wario Land games too, though, you know, I was a good boy and I liked the well-behaved young man like Mario much more than this Wario character.
Well, now that we're all old and understand much more about the realities of the world, we understand that Wario is probably the more realistic character. And there actually is something kind of admirable about Wario and just his pure, undisguised cupidity. He is a gross, greedy person who is just in it for himself, and he makes no pretenses otherwise. And there's something pure about that. He's not like Donald Trump. He's not pretending to care. He's just out there to make a buck, and he does it legally for the most part.
Wario.
When he doesn't do it legally, as we'll see in Virtual Boy Wario Land, you know, he has to pay the price and earn his keep.
Well, he steals from other thieves.
There's something to be said for that.
Yeah, he's a Robin Hood character, yeah. and the first Antifa.
I don't know if he's really a Robin Hood. He's stealing from the rich and just giving to himself.
True.
He's already kind of rich, but you know, whatever. It's fine.
Do you guys remember the Nintendo Power Super Mario Adventure comics?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. At the end, they had the one-off Mario and Wario comic, which I think dealt with the storyline of Super Mario Land 2. But it cast Mario and Wario as childhood friends, and Mario was always a bully, kind of an unknowing bully to Wario. And Wario has been harboring this just passion to get back at Mario the whole time, and Mario is just oblivious to it. And that really colored my understanding of this character, even though it's probably not canon at all.
Not at all.
I feel like Mario is just not treating Wario well.
Yeah, I feel like that's a kind of a popular trope in Japanese comics. I feel like I've seen it a lot, and in fact, I've just been rewatching Ranma 1/2 for the first time in years and years. Yeah. And there's definitely that relationship between Ranma, who is kind of the oblivious like protagonist, but also kind of a jerk without really realizing it, just sort of thoughtless, and his rival Ryoga, who was always kind of the brunt, you know, bore the brunt of it and has had a miserable existence completely unbeknownst to Ranma, who's, you know, just kind of off in the clouds. And yeah, there's definitely that kind of story has been presented through official Nintendo channels. I don't know. Yeah. If it's necessarily legitimate in terms of what Shigeru Miyamoto and so forth thinks. But then again, maybe Shigeru Miyamoto doesn't get a say on it because he wasn't really involved with anything to do with Wario. That's kind of the whole point of Wario.
There's a little bit of spite involved in the official story to this game too, which we'll get to a little later, I think.
I've heard that, but I don't know how much of that is actually true. So if you have some insider knowledge, I'll be interested to discuss that. But yes, we should start with a recap here. This follows very closely after a Gunpei Yokoi episode, the first of apparently two that we're going to do with myself and Bill Mudrin and Matt Alt, talking about the history of Gunpei Yokoi and his work that he performed for Nintendo for like 3 decades. And that is relevant because, of course, Gunpei Yokoi was the sort of lead project designer on the Game Boy, where Wario made his debut, and also on the Virtual Boy. That was his baby. That was his passion project. And Wario Land Virtual Boy is probably the best game for Virtual Boy. If it's not, then it's like top three. You know, it all comes down to taste, but it's a damn good game and deserves to be liberated from the shackles of Virtual Boy. But, you know, that is relevant because it's kind of a tie-in. This episode is kind of a tie-in to that one. But it's also a follow-up on quite a few episodes we've recorded over the past 8 years on the history of Nintendo and the Mario series. We've looked at pretty much all the console games up through Mario Galaxy 2 and the portable games. And most recently, or fairly recently, we looked at Super Mario Land 1 and 2. And we broke Wario Land, Super Mario Land 3, off from those two games, that discussion, because even though it does bear the subtitle Super Mario Land 3, It is not one of those games. It is a very different work and is really the beginning of the Wario Land series and defining Wario as he's kind of the opportunity for Nintendo to break its own rules. Like Nintendo has really kind of set down, you know, its own standards for game design, for level design, for how characters should be presented, how game mechanics work. And Wario makes use of those rules and builds on them. But at the same time, the Wario games constantly subvert that, or at least the good Wario games do, and always work a little differently and work the way that doesn't seem quite right. And it really reflects the character who is like this kind of grotesque parody, this caricature of Mario. And his games are also like that because the way you play a Wario game, it's just not how you play a Mario game. They work differently. And I think, you know, with Super Mario Land and then Super Mario Land 2, the developers behind that, Nintendo Research and Development 1, that division under Gunpei Yokoi, were kind of struggling to find their own expression of Mario. And eventually, I think they just kind of said, you know, what if we don't? What if we just do our own thing under the guise of Mario? And it's a really interesting instance, a really interesting case of a franchise like going off in a completely different direction than where it started and just kind of shedding its own identity along the way. And you know, by the time we get to the end of our discussion of the Wario series, you'll see just how different these games ended up being from the Mario games. But you really see that here with these first two games, which in a lot of ways look and play like a Mario game, but then everything's just not right. And you know, the further you get away from Super Mario Land 2, the further you get away from the classic Mario style and kind of end up playing this series that is kind of its own thing.
Can we go back a bit and talk a little about the naming convention, putting this as Super Mario Land 3? I don't know if that was a genius bit of marketing or if, I don't know, would people not have bought this if it was just called Wario Land? Would they have, like, Wario, who's that? Did they misspell Mario? Like people who hadn't played Mario Land 2? I'm not really sure.
Nintendo has done this a few times where they've either given a game a subtitle that is another game or else thought about doing that and then kind of broke away. Like Super Mario World was originally subtitled Super Mario Brothers 4. Right. And then it just came out of Super Mario World in all regions.
And then Yoshi's Island
is Super Mario World 2.
This is why I call Super Mario Galaxy Super Mario Brothers 17. Just to be real old school about
it's 67, I think, right? Well, actually, so in the Japanese box art for Wario Land 1, it has the Super Mario Land 3 above Wario Land. So that was even Japan was like, I don't know about this Wario guy.
Yeah.
And then Mario's like literally on the box in the corner as like an icon, like hello.
Yeah, and I was watching the international commercials for Wario Land last night, and the Japanese one, its style is Wario's front and center. Wario's taken over the world, and he's climbed, I believe it's Tokyo Tower, King Kong style, and he's that kind of King Kong scale. But then he gets flung off of it, and then at the very end, Mario pops up to say, "Hey, it's me. It's Mario. It's okay. I'm here too." Even though he's like in 8 seconds of the ending of this, and he's not. I guess technically, they can still say Mario is in this game.
It's really like it reminds me of a sitcom. Spin-off kind of what's the backdoor pilot where you know the regular characters are there for like 5 seconds and then oh here's my neighbors, how are you guys doing,
it's the Ropers.
What's up with you,
Super Mario Land 3, the Ropers.
He's the Mork of Mario.
Yes.
Well, I think too, you know, the branding of Super Mario Land, like that was the original Super Mario Land was one of the best selling Game Boy games ever, so it's a very valuable brand for them to put it on the cover. Like that does lend more credence to like this isn't just some wacky new title in case you haven't heard of Wario. This is Super Mario Land 3, so you're in safe hands here.
I think someone believed in Wario because Wario was like the centerpiece of the Mario Land 2 ad campaign. Mm-hmm. Like the giant Wario face was the commercial. Like, I'm Mario. Mm-hmm. Help me defeat Mario. Like that he like there was Wario awareness before this game, even though you didn't see him until the very end of Mario Land 2.
Yeah, that was very 90s, I feel. Like, you think Mario's a good, nice guy? Here's the cool 90s version. Wario, he's got a weird mustache, and he's greedy.
Well, and its colors are neon and ugly, which is very 90s also. So there is definitely the marketing angle on this, but I put forward the proposition that this is extremely, in many ways, a direct follow-up to Super Mario Land 2, not just in terms of narrative, which begins immediately after Super Mario Land 2, when Wario, the villain, is defeated by Mario, and he's spent all this time trying to take over Mario's castle out of spite. And while he's away from his own home, his castle is taken over by the Cinnamon Gang and their mysterious leader, Captain Syrup. So, you know, you immediately follow on, like, Wario has lost. He's, you know, suffered this ignominious defeat at the hands of his rival, and now his other rival has stolen his home and he has to steal it back. And this game is really presented as a journey from the end of that second game to take back Wario's castle. So there is that, but also on top of that, like, if you look at the game mechanics of Super Mario Land, like, the people who designed that game had Mario experience. We've talked about that before, about, you know, how the team, especially Gunpei Yokoi and so forth, and Hirokazu Tanaka, they had worked on games like Mario Brothers. They had worked on Donkey Kong. And then when Super Mario Brothers, you know, kind of went off in its own direction, and Shigeru Miyamoto, who had worked with them on those early Mario games, was put in charge of Nintendo R&D 4, he kind of did his own thing, and Mario, that is the Mario that we know and love. But R&D 1 under Gunpei Yokoi was still making some Mario games. They made a bunch of Game & Watch games that were all kind of weird. You know, there's like Donkey Kong Hockey, but there's also, I can't remember the name of it, but it's Mario and he's in the army. He's like a soldier. Like, it's all these like kind of weird, quirky Mario explorations where he's still that sort of Game & Watch, you know, Mr. Game & Watch everyman. Yeah, but they also created Wrecking Crew, which is, you know, the people say there's a direct connection between Wrecking Crew's nemesis, Chairman or Foreman Spike, and Wario. I don't know if that's deliberate, but you can definitely see some commonalities. It's like the evil, twisted purple version of Mario and Luigi. But Henry, sounds like you were going to say something.
Oh, well, one of my favorite Mario Game & Watches that I played 8 million hours of as a kid was Cement Factory, where that one is just Mario as a businessman, like Mario as a business owner. It takes him away from his everyman style that I think Miyamoto prefers.
The military one was Mario's Bombs Away.
That's it.
Which has the really weird image of Mario in fatigues. But yeah, it was kind of like his Mickey Mouse period, where, you know, he's just like the everyman character. Oh, we can put him as our mascot in, you know, any situation. He doesn't have to be a plumber.
Which side is he fighting for?
Right. So Nintendo R&D 1 still had this connection to Mario, and, you know, Nintendo R&D 1 was the division that created the Game Boy and pretty much all of the Game Boy's early first-party lineup. They worked with Intelligent Systems on a lot of things, but then Super Mario Land was basically like them putting together a Super Mario Brothers-style game, and it's pretty convincing, but it definitely has more of an old-school feel than even Super Mario Brothers. Like, the physics are simpler. And it just has an overall kind of like older school, you know, it feels very much like an evolved Game & Watch title. So I kind of feel like with Mario Land 2, they really wanted to sort of define their own take on Mario and really kind of overcompensated by, instead of creating like this sort of simple, very fast, very kind of linear action style, you know, physics model, they made Mario like super floaty. They made everything really big and, you know, the levels kind of roaming and rambling. And it doesn't really, like, going back to it a few years after having, or like a decade after having last played it for our more recent episode, I was really struck by how little it feels like a Mario game. It's just kind of off.
Yeah, I think the big Mario is kind of key to that. You've talked about this a little in Game Boy Works, I think. But the problem with the Game Boy screen is that if you make the character small enough so you can see a lot of the level, then you really have to squint to see anything. And if you make the character big enough, then you can only see like five blocks ahead of you. And that really ruins the flow for Mario. So the technology is kind of in the way.
the Mario style just doesn't really work that well within the boundaries of the Game Boy. If you want to have like big characters that look, you know, like Super Mario World characters, it's got to be on a screen that has the resolution of a Super NES as opposed to a Game Boy. And so Super Mario Land, the first one, worked pretty well because even though it looks really simple and primitive, like there is a lot of visual information around you and it plays really well. It's actually a pretty easy game if you go back to it. And Mario Land 2, you know, you lose a lot of that. So instead of saying, well, what if we do like a halfway compromise or something? They just said, what if we don't make this Mario game about Mario? And so you get kind of the horrible alternate version of Mario as the protagonist, and he becomes the hero or the anti-hero. He becomes the main character that you control, the player avatar. And because Wario is not Mario, he is not, you know, as nimble or athletic as Mario. Jumping is not really his thing. He's more like a boorish brute who smashes things. It completely changes the flow and style of the game. And all of a sudden, you know, this kind of more limited visual range, it works because you're not jumping as high. You're not running as fast. Wario doesn't even have a run button in the first game. And, you know, from the limitations of the Game Boy and the fact that Mario just doesn't really work that well on the original Game Boy, you get something that is increasingly different the further the series goes along, and in some ways a lot better. Like Wario Land is very distinct, and his best games are really unique and a lot of fun, like really challenging in a totally different way than Mario games ever are.
And despite being on the Game Boy, I think, like, going back to playing this, I feel like they were really advancing the idea of a platformer about not just getting to the end of the level, because they were developing Yoshi's Island around this time too, concurrently with this game. And now you have a platformer that's like, yeah, you can get to the end of the level, but there's something you can find in like half the levels, an additional incentive to explore more. And because this is a slower game, it's not about getting to the end, it's about exploration. And even like the music emphasizes the new tone of the game. It is like fat guy tuba music that follows Wario around.
I have kind of a fan fiction idea of this, but I imagine that R&D1, you know, they feel a certain ownership over Mario, having worked on those games. And I wonder, you know, if like as Miyamoto gets moved up the chain and he gets more, you know, power in the system of Nintendo, I wonder if like he was just putting more rules or expectations on this team that used to be his boss, including Yokoi, like was his boss. So I wonder if their reactions to him, if he was saying, no, Mario doesn't do this, he does that. Mario doesn't do this, do that. He needs to look this way. I've always wondered if Wario just turned into like, well, fine, Miyamoto can't make rules about Wario for us. We'll just have Wario be the main guy who can do the things that we don't have to have an argument with Miyamoto over it.
Yeah.
I'm going to make my own Mario. You can do whatever you want.
I hear that speculation a lot, and it makes sense, but I don't know that it really tracks with just the way things work internally at companies like this. I mean, if you look, R&D1 put together several Mario games for Virtual Boy. There's Wario Land, of course, but they also created Mario Clash and Mario Tennis, the very first Mario sports game, really. So I don't think it's necessarily a thing like, you know, Shigeru Miyamoto was ruling Nintendo with an iron fist or anything like that. I think it was just increasingly, I don't know, like Gunpei Yokoi had a claim to Mario because he had worked on those games. And that's kind of, you know, how I think a lot of Japanese developers look at things like, well, you know, we worked on this, so it's kind of the thing we're working on. They worked on that, and so it's not really our right to go over there. Like you see that on Virtual Boy with Teleroboxer, where, you know, it could have been a Punch-Out game, but the team that worked on it had no connection to Punch-Out. So I don't think it was necessarily like, oh, well, Punch-Out, that's not good enough for us. It's more like, well, you know, that wasn't really our sandbox to play with. Like we should stick to our own toy box and our own creation. So let's do our own thing that's very similar, but has its own style and its own vibe. And so I think really what you see when you look at R&D1's connection to Mario is that it goes away after Yokoi leaves Nintendo, because he did have that connection. And then after he left, you know, in 1996, you don't see any more R&D1 in Mario games. You see the Wario games, but I think it's not so much like they have to do Wario because Miyamoto says so. It's more like once Yokoi left, then who was there who had, you know, that kind of long running connection to Mario? There wasn't really anyone.
I have one more defense on my fan fiction on that, though, is that
okay.
In 1996, it's also when Miyamoto directed his last game of Mario 64 and moved up the chain to a higher executive level, like doing producing on kind of every game. So that could also be why he, like, there was more control over Mario games after 1996 and who got to make them.
Yeah, I feel like, honestly, that could be the case. But I feel like, honestly, it was just a case where R&D1's teams were like, or the, you know, the people who worked there were just like, well, you know, this isn't really our thing anymore. Like, Mr. Yokoi had a lot of connection to Mario, and so, you know, he had a vision for what he saw Mario as, and that was great, but now he's not here, so, you know, it's not really appropriate for us to do this. I think it was probably more voluntary than anything. And I think with Wario, the Wario games, you see that where they're like, yeah, we're kind of working in this Mario style, but we're doing our own thing. And I always hear people speculate about how there's resentment and, you know, like, Mario's so popular and that's not cool because we work really hard and we're creative. So we're just going to stick it to Miyamoto by making a fat, ugly version of his character who's stupid. I don't see that. Like, I just don't think that's how it worked internally. Like, those people, you know, a lot of them still work there. And I would imagine, you know, you don't want to work 30 years at a company where you really resent the people you work with. So I really think it was just that kind of Japanese mentality of like, this isn't really our thing to mess with, and we respect that. So we're going to step back from it. And, you know, we understand our boundaries here, and that's all, that's fine. We've got Wario. We can do weird stuff with him and turn this into like a music game if we want to. That's fine.
I do feel like somebody stepped in after the first game, was like, guys, this is a little too weird. Because if you look at the box art, it is like the very marketable Yoichi Kotabe art. But I love the art in this first game because it is of the like popular gag manga style of the late 80s, early 90s, which we were not exposed to at all. And very little of that comes over here, where it's very intentionally crude. But after this game, Mario becomes a lot less asymmetrical, a lot less like a cubist of a character, and everything becomes a lot cuter. This one is like a very grotesque.
Work done.
What's that? Yes, exactly. Like, he's never been uglier than in this game. And the crudeness is like one of the qualities I like, because it's so intentionally crude, just like the weird enemies and expressions and just how asymmetrical Wario is and how he's always facing you. He's always looking at you when he's running.
Oh, and like, they took one of the things that was complicated about Super Mario Land 2, which is, you know, this giant Mario sprite that it's meant to look like the Mario you see on your TV, but it also doesn't work the same on that scale. And they're like, no, what if he's even bigger? What if that sprite's an even bigger, like, squatter dude, and we go even more in that direction of a giant sprite and design around that?
Yeah, and it works here because they are making a game that's built around that, not trying to make an NES Mario game.
Yeah, and you really kind of see like how inappropriate it is for Wario to be treated as Mario, because in these first two games, they're the ones where he turns small when he takes damage, and his small version is the worst. It's so grotesque. He's like this, just this horrible little homunculus with a like a mohawk. He's really unpleasant to look at.
I like the mohawk, though.
I mean, it's funny. I like the character as a design just because it's so offensive, but it really, like, even more so than for gameplay mechanics, it really compels you to find a power up just so you can stop looking at this grotesque little goblin.
It's like the beeping of the hearts in Zelda.
Yes, or in Metroid. Yes, exactly. Like, here is an annoying thing to make you want to play better.
Yeah, I hate seeing him so much. And and also that he just sucks. Like, he can't do anything.
Yeah.
And you feel 10 times more distance power. I guess too, it's like from the start of 1-1 compared to, you know, the iconic 1-1 of Mario, you always start as little Mario and you feel so awesome. Like, hey, I got my first power up. I'm big. Instead, you start as big Wario. And when you get hit, you're like, I suck now. Boo!
The canonical Wario is his pith helmet.
Yeah, Super Mario is Super Mario. There's Mario and then there's Super Mario. So there is this impression that getting the mushrooms or the flowers, like, it makes you a better version of Mario. Whereas here, you're like, Wario is the big ugly guy who's just like blasting into stuff. And now he's diminished. He's tiny. He can't break anything. He can't hurt anyone. He's just like this miserable little grotesque thing running around. Make it stop.
If you finish a stage as a tiny Wario, it just gives you your Super Wario back or regular Wario back. It's like, we're going to make you big again. You don't want this in your life.
Well, there's multiple stages that if you didn't start with an ability that regular Wario has, you'd be screwed. So they just have to hand it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's weird to go back to this game too, because I think later in the Game Boy Advance games, Wario really can't die at all. He can change formats and he can, like, to solve puzzles, he can get squished or he can set on fire. But in this one, you can actually get small and die, which kind of feels out of character when you go back now.
Yeah, so that's why I've broken the Wario discussion into a few different episodes, because there's a lot to say about each of the games, but these two games, Wario Land and Virtual Boy Wario Land, are really different than the Game Boy Color games, Wario Land 2 and 3. And those are the ones you're talking about where Wario is invincible. Like, he's immortal, basically. He's not invincible because he can be damaged, and that's kind of the point of many of the puzzles. But then Wario Land 4 goes back toward kind of a combination style where those effects still affect him, but he has a health, like a health meter. He has hearts. So he can die. There's a limited number of lives and so forth. But, you know, these first two games are much more in the sort of Mario vein where you have a limited number of lives. You die if you take a hit when you're a grotesque little Wario. And you're always on the hunt for ways to get one-ups to expand your life. So, you know, there's a very kind of different discipline and design philosophy involved with all these games.
I feel like if I was going back and redesigning this game 25 years later, I would steal from Super Mario Odyssey. And, you know, instead of dying and starting back at the beginning of the level, just make Wario lose coins when he gets hurt. Mm. And because coins are so important in this game, that would feel just as bad, but also you wouldn't have to replay the entire level.
Yeah, that's what happens in Wario Land 2. When you take a hit, you lose like 10 coins. And since you're always, as Wario, trying to accumulate wealth, you are the original Nintendo capitalist. You know, losing those coins is a huge detriment because you're trying to earn as much wealth as possible to get the best ending possible. You know, he learned from the greediest, wealthiest of them all, Scrooge McDuck, because that's how the DuckTales endings work. And that carries forward directly into these games.
Now, I do think to get back to those commercials that worked so well on me as a kid, I don't obviously, from everything I've read, Nintendo of America only had so much influence on any game that got made, which, you know, not much. But I definitely think the timing of Wario was perfect for the Play It Loud campaign. That, like, they had to put gross jokes on so many game ads that didn't fit for the game. But when that team was handed Wario, they're like, this is the guy. Like, we got to build around this.
It was the era of, like, Ren and Stimpy being the biggest cartoon. So it's like, who's this gross weirdo we could put front and center?
Man, I mean, the hypnotism commercial is like top five favorite video game commercials in my entire life. Like, just his commandment, and that it's, and also hearing Gary Owens' voice say, like, don't listen to him, kids, help Mario save the day.
He literally hypnotized me into asking for it for Christmas of what, 92?
Yeah.
It worked.
And then
whenever he hears a bell, he has to buy another copy.
And then they did the sequel hypnotism commercial for Wario Land of him with the coin, like, you are greedy, you're going to play as me, that's right, and help me get money. I just love at the end, he's like, get your Game Boy in your Wario Land, greedy. Like, he calls you greedy. It's so great.
It's a really good voice impression.
I'm trying out to replace Martinet, like, if he wants to. Though I don't think it's Martinet in those original commercials. I don't know who it is, but it's not. No offense on Charles Martinet. The guy plays Wario in a different way than Martinet does.
Thank you.
All right, so that is the preamble to the Wario Land games. Now we should talk about the Wario Land games, and we'll do this one at a time, starting with Super Mario Land 3, Wario Land. To begin with, this was, you know, released in 1993 in all regions, kind of within the span of a few months, because Nintendo had kind of gotten its development and international release cycle pretty synced up by this point. So instead of, you know, Europe getting the game like 5 years later, they actually got to have it around the same time as everyone else, which was nice. There's not a lot of text to localize in this game, so it all works. But I'd like to ask, like, what is your experience with this game specifically? Like, is it something you played a long time ago? Bob, you said you asked for it for Christmas. Did Santa deliver?
Oh, I asked for Mario Land 2 for Christmas. With this game, I had Christmas money, and it came down to this and Kirby's Pinball Land. I opted for Pinball Land. So I only played this in the emulation era for the first time, and I was more into Wario Land 2 and 3, so I was like, this one's not as good. But then, for that episode 8 years ago, I finally sat down and played it from beginning to end. And while I prefer 2 and 3, I do really like what's going on here, even though it's not that as innovative. I think it's innovating in places where Mario doesn't, and like exploring places where Mario doesn't in terms of platformers.
Mm-hmm. Henry?
My experience was, as an 11-year-old Mario super fan, I got this, in my Game Boy day of 93, I actually turned my nose up at it because I felt, well, I really was like, this isn't Mario. Like, I turned against it not being exactly a Mario game, and in my very strict definition of what Mario should be. And then it got the kiss of death for me continuing with a series, which was my little brother liked it more.
Oh, no.
And so when it turned into the little brother's game, I was like, well, then he can have it. So he played 2 and 3 and was telling me how fun they were and awesome, but I was like, whatever, I'm playing Yoshi's Island over and over again. But then when I finally gave it another shot, I think it was on sale or something on the 3DS, so I bought it on the 3DS some years ago, and just pulled it back out for this, and I was like, yeah, you know, this is pretty good. I liked it. I like it more now, but I turned on it in when it was brand new because it wasn't my exact definition of what a Mario game should be.
Right. Well, Kyle?
Yeah, like most Game Boy games in the 90s, my experience with this was during long car rides up from DC to New York to visit family. So I put in a lot of hours on this in the backseat of that car. And I remember this was before I had access to the internet and GameFAQs, where it could just tell you where all the hidden treasures were. And I don't think they ever made like a guide for it. Maybe they mentioned a few of the secrets in Nintendo Power, but there was no, I didn't have access to like a comprehensive cheat sheet, like where are all these things. So I remember spending hours and hours while we were driving on I-95 just using every item and looking in every little corner for those last few treasures. And I finally found them on one of those trips. And I'm like, thank God I could finally get the good ending and be done with it, because I was on the verge of just giving up. And it was really satisfying to have a game where it wasn't just, oh, you know, I'm going to play Mario Land again, and maybe I can finish with 99 lives this time. Actually having some reason to go back and forth and find all the hidden nooks and crannies really made it feel different.
Yeah, like for whatever reason in the 90s, I just completely glossed over this game. I just had zero interest in it. It was like my brain didn't even register its existence for some reason. I don't know why. But then in 2001, I attempted to move away from Texas, and that didn't quite work out. I ended up like trying to establish myself and start a life around the New York area. And then after a few months realized, well, yeah, I don't really have the credentials to do that, so no one wants to hire me. So on my ride home of defeat, I had recently played through the Game Boy Advance Wario Land 4 and really loved it. So I was like, you know, I'm finally going to play this old Game Boy game, and played it a bit in the car. But then after that, I kind of associated the game with the sadness of having like failed at life. So I went a long time without really giving it another go. But you know, I've kind of poked at it here and there over the years. And after playing through Virtual Boy Wario Land last year for Virtual Boy Works, I think I have a better appreciation for the style of game. So, you know, replaying it now for this episode, I really enjoyed it. I didn't get to beat it all the way through that I'd hoped to, But I did play, you know, a good chunk of it. And now I want to sit down with it on like a Super Game Boy and just kind of soak it in on a big screen and really, you know, 100% it if I can. I don't ever do that with games, but this is one of those where I feel like it's pretty feasible because it's not a super huge game. And while the treasures can be hidden pretty effectively, there is always the internet if something gets too annoying and I can just say, okay, yeah. I give up. What is it?
It's now you can say that.
Now I say that because I waited. That's what patience will do for you.
It's only a 4 to 5 hour game, and even though I finished it like 8 years ago for the first time, I didn't need to look up any treasure secrets. Like if you know what Wario's abilities are and what he can do with them, it's pretty I wouldn't say it's easy, but it makes sense as to where to find the treasures.
Although yeah, as like a 13 year old I was still in the old Mario like just go left to right. You'll get to the end. And then I had this helped me learn like where secrets were hidden in Mario games and where to look for things.
I will say the game does gaslight you because in the first set of stages, there are no secret treasures. And every time I was like, I got to play this again. I know I missed something, but you don't actually get to the secret treasures until you get to the second set of stages. And then once you do some world map shenanigans, you can go back to the first set of stages and find some new stuff.
Yeah, I'd always kind of ignored the treasure count at the end because I didn't care. But this time I was playing and I was like, why the hell have I not found a treasure? And I finally found one and it was like 8 or 9 stages in and it was treasure B. I was like, okay, I get it. So there weren't actually treasures in these stages. There are more stages than there are treasures. Mm-hmm. I got it. Okay. But yeah, it does kind of throw you because you're like, what the hell is this for? But that's Wario for you. It's just, you know, the game is always kind of twist your expectations just a little bit, just enough so that you kind of like question yourself and you're like, am I doing something wrong? No, it's just Wario. But you know, the way you describe the levels, how you're kind of poking around, exploring a little bit, I feel like with this game and, you know, the subsequent series that followed, Nintendo R&D1 really brought a little of their Kid Icarus / Metroid juice to bear on this particular series. It was basically like combining Metroid and Mario. This is not a massive contiguous world where you're exploring and gaining power-ups that'll permanently upgrade your skills as in Metroid, but it does have more of that Metroid sensibility. You know, there is more of a sense of like you are in a world that makes sense. And you know, you saw some of that with Super Mario World, where you had this kind of world map that evolved and changed, and that is carried directly in here, where the world map changes and actually has more drastic impact on the playability of stages and the accessibility of stages than it does in Super Mario World. But at the same time, I feel like the level designers really spent a lot of time thinking about the logic of how all the levels relate to each other. And if you sit down and you like go to vgmaps.com or something and you look at all the levels, there is like this real genuine kind of logical flow of and connectivity between all the stages. And I kind of tried to map that out in my descriptions of the stages, which hopefully we'll get to, but it really does feel like that kind of Metroid sensibility. And, you know, of course, Gunpei Yokoi had been the producer on both this and Metroid, but Hiroji Kiyotake, the original artist for Wario, who was one of the two co-directors of this game, he was an artist on Metroid and did a lot of design work on previous Metroid games. And as a result, I really think, you know, this game being headed up by an illustrator, by an artist, by a designer who had worked on that exploratory series, you know, he brought that sensibility, that methodology from that series, from Metroid, over to this game and added it to what is ultimately a linear platformer. And, you know, it really shows that this is not a Metroidvania game, but it is a world. It is a contiguous space that, even though it's kind of weird and goofy, like it makes sense the way things interconnect to one another. And there is a logic to it. And it's really neat to see how the changes in the world, you know, you throw a switch or something like the Switch Palaces in Mario World, and all of a sudden, like, hey, this level that I've been to before, it's different now. I need to go back and explore it and see what I can find there. It's really cool.
Yeah, the world map stuff, I think it ended here for Nintendo, and it was really only like Mario 3, Mario World, Mario Land 2, and this. And then they were like, what if it was just like a bunch of nodes on Yoshi's Island? And I really missed that because I love the continuity between the levels themselves and where they are on the world map. And also, like you said, Jeremy, like how things you're doing on the world map are affecting levels, and it makes a lot of sense. I think there's something missing interesting in future platformers in that respect, and I totally wanted to come back. I think Mario 3D World had kind of world mappy stuff, but it was very superficial.
It was frustrating because it wasn't as rich as I thought it was going to be when I first started playing. I was like, oh wow, cool, it's going to be like Mario World. No, it's just like New Super Mario Brothers, except, you know, spread out visually on a map, but it works the same.
Although there is that whole, that entire hidden world, like you find one secret exit and it branches off into like four or five levels. So if you miss that one, I thought that was not, maybe not mind blowing, but I was like, wow, if you miss this, you miss like a good chunk of the game.
Mm-hmm. Well, and New Super Mario Brothers U was really trying to just be Super Mario World again and did a really great job of it. And it has, a pretty in-depth world map, and I felt like 3D World just had its world map because they're like, well, New Super Mario Brothers just did it, so we'll have a world map too. But yeah, it wasn't as involved as it could be. I did like walking around on it in 3D space with Mario. That was fun.
Yeah, I mean, the whole like, hey, I found a secret exit. Again, that is Super Mario World's gift to the Super Mario and Wario series both, where you have like massive chunks of the game hidden behind one little secret. And there's always some sort of pointer to say, hey, you missed something. Like in Wario Land, every stage is numbered when you begin. It'll say like course 1, course 9, etc. And when you beat, I think, Mount Teapot and go to the caldera, basically the caverns, the burning caverns, you jump from like stage 13 to 20 or something, you know, it's a noticeable jump and you're like, wait, there's something missing here. So it doesn't actually say, hey, you missed out on something, you better go find it, go over here and look, but it's going to nag at you and you're going to say like, hey, there's something missing. And if you're hunting for treasures and completing the treasures, you're going to notice there's like two or three treasures missing and in the like a gap in there. So what does that mean? So it really kind of pushes you to figure things out. So it's very subtle, but very effective, I think.
I think they also put a dot on the world map if there's a secret exit. I could be wrong.
No, you're right.
About this. Yep. Kind of like the red levels in Mario World. So that was a nice hint.
So we've talked a little bit about how the levels relate to one another, how the world map functions, but I think it's more important to talk about kind of just the basics of gameplay. And we sort of touched on that, you know, Wario is a big character. He is the same height basically as Mario, but he's much wider. So he takes up even more of the tiny Game Boy screen, but it's okay because he doesn't have a run button. He can charge briefly, but it only, you know, takes him like three panels or so of the ground. And you can't really chain that into a running jump. It just doesn't work the same way as Mario's leaping and even Wario's jumping. Like, he can't jump as high as Mario. He doesn't have the running jump ability to give him extra height. And when he jumps on an enemy, it does not kill an enemy. Like, that's a big change, because when Mario jumps on an enemy, unless it's got a spike on it, it either kills the enemy or it, like, you know, takes the enemy down a notch and then you have to jump on it again. But if Wario jumps on an enemy, even though he's a bigger guy than Mario, it just stuns the enemy. But on the other hand, you can just walk into an enemy, and if you don't hit something spiky, that will also stun the enemy. So there's no more, like, it's not more effective to jump on an enemy than just to walk into them.
And there's one wrinkle that's only in this game, in that you can hold up to jump higher, which feels weird, but I eventually got used to it, but I'm glad they didn't include it in the other games.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how many people totally missed that. I when I was replaying this, I had forgotten about it for like the first half of the game, and then I was like accidentally holding up while holding right when I jumped. I was like, what happened? How did I jump so much higher and faster? And then you're just like holding up for the entire game because it increases your range, it increases your speed. It's how you want to do it the whole time. So it's a really weird control quirk.
It didn't teach me, the game didn't teach me that very effectively, but I do really like how early they're able to teach you through gameplay of watching that mole is stand in front of a sign that says up and B, and it's like, ah, okay, that's how I pull out my coins. That I like that.
Yeah, the up button does have that alternate functionality, which gets to kind of the real, not the really big, but another really big change of the Wario series, in that if you, like Henry said, if you hold up and press B, then Wario will actually pull money out of his pocket. He'll pull a tin coin out of his pocket, and you can use that. You have to use it to buy midpoint saves, so that if you die, you don't have to go back to the beginning of the stage. So there's like this kind of proto Dark Souls sort of challenge there. Like, do I spend my money, my precious money that I need to buy the best ending, or do I risk it? And at the same time, you also have to buy the access to the exits occasionally. But it gets to a really fundamental change of Wario. Not only does he not jump on enemies to kill them like Mario does, coins don't give you lives. Coins, you know, currency has its own intrinsic value. You just want money. You're not getting points for the money. You're not getting, just like extra lives for the money. There's an entirely different mechanic for extra lives. You are Wario, and like, you have more important things to do with that money, namely keep it and, you know, add it to your pile of loot. So your relationship with coins is very different here than it is in Mario games.
Mm-hmm. And I like how it's totally bizarro world, just the way that these collectibles act, and that coins, you don't just collect them automatically when you hit the blocks. They fly out. And the hearts that you collect in the game to get extra lives, they just stick to the block they come out of. And I don't know if we talked about, I'm sure we'll talk about it soon, but the throwing mechanics in these games, they're a little wonky, they're a little clunky, but there's a surprisingly sophisticated amount of physics in this game, when just keeping track of where things are on the screen and keeping track of like where they're bouncing around. It would get a lot better in future games, but they are really having a lot of fun with that idea.
And also the Mario Land hearts, just that, like, they, you know, hearts aren't a big part of the visual aesthetic of regular Mario games, but they were in the Land games, and here they take it to another level. And also, I just love, you know, if you're starting the game thinking it's a Mario game, the first time you hit one of the blocks, it's like you hurt the block.
Yes.
Like, the eyes are pained because you took something from them.
They get, like, the GoGo 13 serious look on them.
And I love that. That, again, it's like the aesthetic of Wario's like a jerk. Like, he's stealing. It's not like a question block that just happily gives up money to Mario and you don't think about, like, damage done or anything.
Going back to the mechanics just a little bit, one thing I don't know if a lot of casual players notice is that if you charge off of a ledge, you'll actually stay in midair for a while, and you can jump even though you're not on the ground, as long as you do it before the end of your charge. I don't think this was actually used, like, necessary to find any secrets, but I always saw these jumps and like, oh, maybe if I have a bull charge and can jump with the up button, I can really make this super long jump. It felt a little bit like Donkey Kong Country, which has a similar mechanic with the rolls.
Huh, that's interesting. But this came before Donkey Kong Country, therefore Donkey Kong Country kind of feels like Wario Land, if we're being honest.
Rare just totally stole it, I'm sure.
Jerks.
I guess in both cases, they make a villain of a Mario game a star in a different-ish way.
It's true.
So that's probably a good opportunity to talk about power-ups, because the power-up cycle here is different. It takes from Mario Land 2 the fact that hats are basically what confers powers onto you, but you have totally different powers and hats than you did in Mario Land 2. And your power set does change in very different ways than it does in Mario games. So I mentioned that, you know, jumping on enemies doesn't kill them, it just stuns them. To kill an enemy and to get a coin from killing an enemy, you have to charge into them. And then two of the three power-ups kind of supplement your charging ability. There's the bull hat, which changes out your pith helmet for a Viking helmet, basically, where you've got bull horns. And so you have a more powerful, aggressive charge that damages things more effectively. And then you have the jet hat that allows you to basically charge through midair for several screens in length. Like, you can fly kind of a long way in a straight line.
Mm-hmm. And the bull hat is pretty OP because it has that butt stomp that will paralyze everything on the screen temporarily. And when I was playing through this entire game again, I noticed that the power-ups are really more utility for exploration than they are for attacking enemies, just because so much of the game is based around, like, you get to a spot like, oh, do you have the bull hat? You need the bull hat to get past this block to pound, or else you can't find the treasure or secret exit, or, oh, you need the bird hat to fly over here to get the key for the treasure. So much of it is really based around, like, how these power-ups allow Wario to explore the territory and destroy certain kinds of blocks.
And it's such a natural progression for the Land series, because, you know, the Super Mario Land 1, they have no colors, and it's really hard to express, like, I guess you just have to count on the player to know that they have the Powerball ability. You can't really visually see it. Then for 2, they figure out, like, all right, what if a thing just changed on Mario's head? A feather, bunny ears, stuff like that. So now for the next game, they're like, okay, it's all about hats. Big visual hats that you can tell the difference on. What they have, and it was once they get into a world where you can have colors on Wario, the hats are less important. They can mess around with color and changes in that way, but I like the change. The hats make more sense for Wario than they did for Mario, even.
Yeah, I remember the jet hat being kind of a blessing and a curse for me, because, like you said, you can, like, fly across multiple screens. So I would always try and get, like, as high as possible and then just fly across. And, like, maybe there's a secret here, like, 2 screens down really high up that I couldn't see. So I had to explore every level like that. And then if I lost the jet hat, I'd have to go back and find another jet hat. And eventually I found all the treasures, and I was like, I do not need to do this anymore. But I spent a lot of time just cruising around parts of the level that no one really should be visiting.
And I also really like with the hat stuff that the save screen, or the menu, the file choice screen, is Wario flying into the stage, knocking off his Mario copycat hat, and then getting his pith helmet on. I like that too.
Yeah, Bob, I like what you mentioned about how power-ups are really utilitarian for exploration, because, again, Wario's relationship with enemies in this game is really different than Mario's is. Like, anytime Mario touches an enemy with anything besides his feet from above, it hurts him. Whereas here, you're more likely to hurt enemies. Unless you touch a pointy part on a bad guy, you're going to either cause the bad guy to bounce off of you or to stun it. Even characters that are, like, as large as Wario. The duck pirates and the little bulldog dudes with swords or whatever they are, like, they will all be stunned or, you know, kind of reel from touching Wario. And you don't have to charge at them to do that. You just touch them, like, walk into them. That's how bulky and powerful Wario is. And it really gives the game a different feel. So it's more like enemies are a thing that you're kind of avoiding, or they're targets of opportunities to get extra hearts and coins, but they're not really an impediment so much as they are in Mario games.
Yeah, and you can see that the idea of enemies not being as important and these power-ups as a utility for exploration is doubled down upon in the second game, where in this game it's just like, oh crap, I didn't hold on to the bull hat power-up and I need it here. There's not another one in the stage. I have to leave and come back, so I'm wasting a lot of time. In Wario Land 2, it's just like, oh, do I need to be Fire Wario? Well, here's the fire-breathing enemy right here in the area where I need to be Fire Wario. Mm-hmm. Let's do this. Instead of having that thing that future Mario Brothers games do that I don't like, where it's like, okay, hold on to this power-up. Don't get hit. I don't like that challenge, because the punishment is just wasted time.
All right, so that's, I'd say, a pretty effective rundown of how the game plays. I do want to touch briefly on the levels and the bosses before we move on to Virtual Boy Wario Land, just because I think the levels in this, like I said, you know, I really like the way that they interrelate and how each individual stage has its own kind of texture and feel that fits into the larger area, and then each area's world, like the level designs, fit into the idea of a larger world. But you start out on just a beach, and it's pretty much just a beach. Like, it's a lot of straight land, very flat. There's barrels and stuff around, you know, because you're facing off against pirates. So you see all these, like, pirate elements around. But as you venture further in and basically move away from the beach, you go through caverns and through tide pools and things like that. And each of the levels reflects that. It's just, you know, when you're playing moment to moment, it just feels like, well, here's more space that I'm running through. But again, when you pull back and look at the overview of the entire game, you're like, oh, I see how all of this fits together. And it really starts on the first stage, the first areas, where you are starting basically at the water on the beach and then moving inland to fight your way through, what's the name of the island? Kitchen Island. Yes, there we go. So everything, of course, has kind of a food theme because it's Japanese media in the 90s and they love their food themes.
Well, and like Bob said, with the gag manga aesthetic really does come through here. It's like how, it, like original Dragon Ball, the first issues of it, or the Dr. Slump, like just, it's a cheesy pun, a bad pun, like a knowing pun of like, yeah, this is a bad pun. We put it there. What you going to do about it?
Yeah, the Rice Beach stages are pretty simple, but they change up a bit later in the game. And you always kind of get an indication that, hey, something has changed someplace in the world. So it's not just like a surprise, like you kind of know to go back to those stages, but they get remixed a little bit. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Mega Man 3 with the Shadow Robot Master stages after you beat the first eight bosses. But it's not quite that dramatic. It's just like, here's a new version of the stages, or now something has changed and you can get past enemies you couldn't before. So now you can find a treasure. It's just a little, you know, a little incentive to keep poking around and, you know, go back and consider these places you've been to with a different context.
We actually, we didn't mention how the treasures work, but I just want to talk about it really quick because I do like
it
this game. And that, well, the first set of stages, you're like, where are the treasures? I was told there were treasures. And there clearly aren't, sir. Excuse me. But then in the game, it does a really great job of presenting either the key first or the door the key needs to go in first in very different ways. Like, there's a lot of variations on what you find first. And I just like how it encourages you to, like, oh, there's the door. Okay, now I need to find the key. It's like, oh, I have the key. Now I need to carry this around, and my utility is you know, decreased because I'm carrying a key around. I need to find the door now. I just like how they switch it up a lot more than they do in the next game.
Yeah, the grabbing the key and carrying it to the treasure room kind of reminds me of a game from the same year, Castlevania Rondo of Blood, where there's one stage where you have to find a key as a sub-weapon and hang on to it while evading enemies in order to unlock a jail cell at the end of the stage. Whereas this takes that and it creates all kinds of interesting puzzles and dynamics around it. So yeah, like you said, sometimes you'll start a level and the treasure door is right there at the start. But it doesn't do any good because you don't have the key. So it does become this kind of challenge to find keys, find the treasure doors, hold onto the key long enough to get to the treasure door, and still make it out of the level in time before you run out of time to finish the stage. So it creates a lot of different interesting challenges that are something beyond just like get to the end of the level. And that it really does kind of help define Wario Land as something unique and different.
And just visually, too, I like how those treasure doors, the keyhole is literally as big as Wario's head. It's like, you do not want to miss this. This is a real big thing.
And at Rice Beach, the villain of it, too, the final boss of it is, I like that it's like a punk rock Koopa Trooper. Like, it's
Basically
a rejected design, or a biker, I guess, maybe. Like a rejected design for a Koopa Trooper that you'd be like, this guy's too mean to be in a Mario game.
90s.
Yeah, this the boss in this stage is very much kind of, it does feel like the Mario world enemies, where they like retract into their shell and spin around. But this one will fly into the air and spin around, and you can't hurt him until he flips upside down and tries to skewer you on the spikes on a shell. And then he lands, you know, he gets stuck in the sand for a second, and you have just a brief instant to bop him on his exposed underpart. But he can also dig underneath and burrow into the sand and then come out from underneath you, kind of like, what are some other enemies who have done that? Like Hard Man and Mega Man 3. Mm-hmm. Yeah, keep the Mega Man 3 thing going. It's always good. but yeah, like each of the bosses has its own kind of style. Some of them are easier than others. Like the second boss is, I think you only have to hit him once if you do it right, and you can just throw him into the magma. But then the third boss of the secret world, Sherbert Land, is a penguin who, when you attack him, he puts on a Koopa shell as a hat, which I think is a really fun way to kind of tie back into the Mario theme while also playing up the hat mechanic. Like, hey, the bosses can do that too, and they've got Mario connections.
I think you can't beat him as Tiny Wario, but his boss area has a door you could just leave. You could just leave the stage without beating him. It was a weird choice. Yeah. One of these, and I think it's this guy. They're just, the door to leave is there, so you can play through the stage and then just walk away.
Yeah, and they would really play that up with Wario Land 2, where in a lot of boss battles, the challenge is like beating the boss without getting kicked out of the arena and having to start over. This isn't that annoying, fortunately.
Going back to Rice Beach, I think when that punk rock turtle is going up in the air, you can actually just jump and hit its underbelly from below.
Yeah.
I guess that makes sense. Wario does that, huh?
Yeah.
I think that's early enough in the game that you're still thinking in Mario terms.
That is
right.
That's
how
I beat it.
Used to anything that's not spiky is just, oh, you can hit it from anywhere.
Yeah, we don't necessarily need to belabor the point, but you know, after Rice Beach is Teapot Mountain, which, you know, the levels become much more vertical, but you start out basically with like you're kind of swimming your way toward the mountain from the beach. And then the secret world is technically next, Sherbet Land, where everything is mostly takes place in an iceberg. And so, you know, the level is slippery, but you also have to deal with a lot of water areas. There's Stove Canyon, which is not to be mistaken for Steve Canyon. And it has a lot of, you know, it kind of reminds you of the level design of Rice Beach and the water areas there, except the water, of course, is deadly magma. So you don't want to fall in because you can swim in water, but not so much in magma. Wario is tough, but not that tough. But you start getting a lot of gimmicks in Stove Canyon, such as mine carts, which become kind of a mainstay throughout the remainder of the game. And it's not like the super annoying mine carts where like one little mistwitch and you're gone. It's more like little segments where you're briefly riding on a mine cart and then you have to jump off while avoiding enemies to land on safe space. So I feel like it's kind of a happy medium between mine carts and fun.
And the train stages are really cool that incorporate the mine carts more towards the end. I do like how that changes up that way. You're not just outside, you're actually on moving trains.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about once you complete the SST Cup stages, you're basically making your way through the woods from the boat, the teacup, to Syrup's castle, and you go through a forest, but it's not your typical forest stages. A lot of it is you have like piranha plant type enemies, or you know, the munches or whatever they're called from Super Mario. But a lot of it is like the pirates have built a rail system, I guess, to take Wario's treasure from his castle to their boat. And like they've built up this elaborate system to plunder Wario's home. And so you're making use of this whole structure that they've created.
Oh, and I also really like the quicksand bits too. Like being able to hop up through the quicksand, but it changes your ability to do it. And also, like, they somehow made Thwomps even scarier looking in this world too. Like they're
but you
covered
can jump on Thwomps' heads and use that as a safe platform. So that's a nice change. Like they nerfed them in one respect and made them scarier in others.
It's presaging Super Mario 64, where you could do the same thing.
Yeah, but the like the teacup stages and the Syrup Castle stages really give me kind of a Castlevania vibe.
Oh yeah,
where the places that they're named after, the boat and the castle, are really kind of like half of that world, if that much. And most of it is like actually the run up to those spaces. So you know, with Syrup Castle, you have to go through a stage that is just the forest getting you to the castle. And then, you know, with the teacup, you're actually crossing through shoals and across beaches and things like that just to get to the boat. And then once you actually get to the boat, then, yeah, you've got like this huge, like completely unrealistic boat where you're working your way up through the rigging and to the mast. But, you know, it's really about the journey and the real sense that Wario is on a quest to get back to his castle and take back the castle from Captain Syrup, who turns out to be a lady as opposed to the man that she is mentioned as in the manual. Again, shades of Metroid.
Yeah, I mean, I like that manual story in general. And yeah, you get the Metroid thing, and also of the reveal of it's a girl. And also it's an inversion again of Mario tropes of like, you came all the way to this castle not to save a princess but to fight one, and you're
to save your castle from the princess,
and then then Mario steals your princess at the end.
He
steals the statue. I have to say, I feel really stupid, but at this point in the podcast, I just understand the pun kitchen island, you know, like a thing you have in your kitchen,
yes,
the kitchen island.
Right.
I've never been that rich to have a kitchen island.
I just got that right now.
I guess I sort of have one in here, but it's
don't kid yourself, Henry.
Junk.
Don't kid yourself.
No, that's not an island.
That's
my
a divider.
You're right. Yeah.
Going back to that Mario and Wario comic, you know, at the end here, Mario just comes in and steals the statue that Wario spent this entire game working so hard to unlock and steal back from Captain Syrup. And it's like, Mario, you did not earn that. Wario stole it fair and square. You are just coming in and taking advantage of all his hard work. It's Wario. It should be Wario's statue.
Yeah. So you adhere to the possession of 9/10 of the law.
Yeah, well, I just want to see hard work valued, I guess.
Mario, I didn't finish the Virtual Boy game, so I don't know if he appears there. But I think this is the last appearance of Mario in the Wario Land series, and I think someone was like, he's not showing up in these. He doesn't make an appearance. He's ours. because he's kind of a dick in this game.
Yeah. Well, I like that. Well, again, look, as far looking at it from Mario's perspective, someone stole that Princess Toadstool statue and he's just taking it back. So he shows up and he's like, oh, there's a stolen statue. I'm going to take it back for Princess Toadstool, my boss. Like, it's on Mario's part. He's not stealing. He's just like, maybe even thinks that Wario got it for him. He's like, hey, thanks, Wario. You stole it. You freed it from these guys. I'll be taking it with me.
So yeah, you go back to the manual. It says in the story section, rumor has it that the pirates of Kitchen Island have stolen this giant golden statue of Princess Toadstool. Mario is looking for it, but if I find it first, I could cash it in for a princess's ransom.
Mm.
I could buy a castle that is way bigger than Mario's pathetic excuse for a castle. So on the one hand, you know, Wario is motivated by spite. It's not just, oh, I want a lot of money. It's I want to show up Mario, and Mario really wants this statue, so I'm going to find it first. But on the other hand, it's kind of implied that it was a golden statue of Princess Toadstool that was in Mario's castle, or maybe in the Mushroom Kingdom in general. I don't know who's the rightful owner, so maybe Mario's just returning it to where it was.
Mm.
We're getting way too deep into something.
I think we can all agree that however it ended up in Wario's castle, it was not through a legitimate transaction.
I mean, too, Mario Land 2 will teach you that Mario seemingly took over some island and is like, no, this is mine, a statue's to myself, my own castle. He has set up his own area separate from the Mushroom Kingdom where he is the god.
He cashed in his 80s coins for that.
As a theme park, kind of like Mario Land, like this new Super Nintendo world. He just made a theme park for himself.
Okay.
But in the end, it all works out for Wario because, you know, the money that he acquired throughout his journey, he can give to the genie that Captain Syrup unleashes upon him and he defeats in order to exchange it for a better place to live. And based on how much money you've acquired and the number of treasures, that can be anything from like a log cabin to a castle. And if you max out everything, you get all the treasures and get 99,999 coins, then the genie is so impressed that he basically gives you your own mini moon with your face on it. It's a very small moon. It is not much larger than Wario, but it is emblazoned with his face. And so that's all a greedy, selfish, vain person could ever really want.
I think it's BS you have to pay a genie money to do something.
That's a weird idea.
Is there any mythological precedent for this? Are there any old stories where like the genie requires you to be rich?
No,
I don't think so. No, I think this is just the genie. This genie is more of a contractor than
I guess so, yeah.
Day laborer. right, so that is Wario Land, Super Mario Land 3, and the next game in the series came in 1995, about 2 years later, 2.5 years later, for the benighted Virtual Boy. It was released in November 95 here and December 95 in Japan, and not in Europe because the Virtual Boy was not alive long enough for Europe to get it. And it's actually a very, very good game, despite being on hardware that is widely regarded as a disaster. It's just a fantastic take on Wario Land. It's more refined in a lot of ways. I think it's a smaller game, but the game in a lot of ways feels bigger because there's much, much more to each of the stages. There are only 10 exploratory platforming stages in Wario Land for Virtual Boy, as opposed to 38 in Wario Land for Game Boy, but they're so big and so intricate. Like, you're given 20 minutes to complete each stage. And at first you're like, wow, that's so much time. But by the end of the game, like actually finishing those stages and getting everything in them, all the treasures, it's very difficult to do that in 20 minutes. Those stages are that big, which is really interesting because, you know, all these Virtual Boy games took pains to say, hey, you've been playing for 15 minutes. Yeah. Shouldn't you maybe rest your eyes, take a break? Whereas this is like 15. Nah, you got 20, kids. Go for it.
So R&D1 wanted to blind children, is what you're saying.
Yes. It's typical of Wario. You know, he's just a bad guy. He's trying to mess up kids.
He's going
to
sell you LASIK in about 5 years. So I did play this for the first time, obviously not on the original hardware. It's very easy to find if you want to play it on your PC or whatever. I will say that like it does feel like a very refined second draft of the first game, with some changes I do like and some changes I don't like. I played about half of the game through two sittings, and I don't recommend that because if you play these stages back to back, they do get a little tedious and they do feel a little too big. But I honestly feel like the original context for you to play this game was you sit down for 20 minutes to play one stage, and that is the max amount of Wario Land for the Virtual Boy you are allowed to have in a day by law. A doctor will say no more. So I feel like if you want to get the best experience out of this game, just play like one stage a day, because I honestly feel like I said, this is like every level is like your comprehensive Wario Land Virtual Boy experience, because they didn't expect you to play this entire game in one sitting.
So I actually played this on the original hardware back in the original day. I was not silly enough to buy a Virtual Boy, but I rented one from Blockbuster when that was still a thing. And rented a copy of this. And I did not play one level at a time. I definitely hurt my eyes and hurt my back leaning over the kitchen table to try and play it with that awkward stand. And then when I was replaying it for this, I actually got an emulator that works with a virtual reality headset.
Oh, cool.
I wanted to get that 3D effect. And it works really well. There's this mode where instead of being tied to your eyes, it like projects a big 3D screen in your relative space. So you kind of just step back and it's like having a huge red 3D TV in front of you. And it really feels like, I mean, it's obviously not the way it was envisioned to be played, but I think it's the way it's meant to be played because it was really enjoyable. I could just sit there for an hour or two and blaze through levels. And maybe it was a little tedious, but I didn't have that eye strain. I didn't have to lean over the controller. And, you know, I think this game is really let down by its original hardware. I wish Nintendo had done like a 3DS virtual console version where you could still get that 3D effect and, you know, introduce it to a new generation. Otherwise, it's just going to be lost.
Urban Champion got a 3DS remake, but this didn't.
I think it really is just internal shame about Virtual Boy. Yeah,
Virtual Boy was supposed to be head mounted originally, but because of the shielding they had to build into it to prevent, you know, the radio emissions from scrambling your brain or whatever, it ended up being too heavy for that. So it's one of the many compromises the system experienced in its development. Binge Edwards has written a great piece on this on Fast Company. So look up Binge Edwards. Virtual Boy retrospective, Fast Company, and it's got all kinds of anecdotes from people who were involved in various degrees of the project and can talk about that. So, yes, I agree. You're right. I think head-mounted 3D is the way that it was meant to be played, but I did not get to play this back originally on Virtual Boy hardware and tried it on emulation, but the emulation for Virtual Boy does not work well on Macintoshes, or at least it didn't when I tried it. But, you know, ultimately, I got a Virtual Boy modded for video output, so I got to play it on a CRT television, in which case it basically just looks like a beautiful, like you know, there was a device called Super Game Boy, but this Virtual Boy is the Super Game Boy. It's got the same four-tone monochrome graphics. You switch it so it's outputting in gray as opposed to red. And it's just, it's beautiful. Like, it is such a gorgeous game. The Virtual Boy had so much more resolution than Game Boy. You know, Game Boy was 160 by 144. And I think Virtual Boy was like 372 by 240 or something. It's like widescreen and just, you know, many times the amount of pixel information as on Game Boy. But, you know, Wario Land, as we talked a little earlier, Wario Land's design was based on the fact that it was constrained to the Game Boy's resolution. So when you strip away those limitations, the designers were like, wow, we can do a lot here. So you have these really big detailed levels, but populating them, you have maybe the best 2D sprites of any Nintendo game. Like they're four color, you know, black and white, four shade black and white, but they're so detailed. Wario is like twice the size of his Game Boy sprite, and he's animated incredibly well. He has like so many different expressions. The enemies are all designed to equal size as well. The levels, you know, there's a lot of kind of minimalism about the game. So you're getting like lots of shadow and then just details kind of popping out of the black because of the way Virtual Boy's graphics look. But everything is just so well rendered and so detailed. It's such a nice looking game.
Yeah, this and Yoshi's Island, same year, same season. Yeah. It was their best 2D graphics until they just threw it all away.
Yeah. Well, just put polygons in 2D. That's as good. No, I didn't play this when it was new. If I maybe at some tech demo thing at a Toys R Us or Blockbuster, I played it for like a minute until my eyes hurt. But I watching your Virtual Boy video on it, Jeremy, really gave me so much more appreciation for the Virtual Boy, because I never thought about it in comparison to a piece of hardware with the Game Boy. But having played Wario Land and then seeing Virtual Boy Wario Land, which is just so, it is just a graduation from the previous one, you really do see how the Virtual Boy is more technologically advanced than the Game Boy, that we all overlooked because you just couldn't look at a Virtual Boy that long to appreciate all the things it could do that a Game Boy couldn't. And
I will never get tired of saying that they should have just taken the Virtual Boy's processor and visual output and just made like the Ultra Game Boy. Just give us a system with widescreen resolution, monochrome graphics. That would have, In 1995, that would have killed. It would have been so incredible, and it would have gotten support. There would have been Pokemon games for it. People would have loved it. And then they could have done a color iteration later, but that's not the way it went. It's very sad. But yes, this game really, really speaks to kind of what was actually happening in terms of the tech design aesthetic of Virtual Boy's graphical output. And it's just like this, it opens your mind to this alternate reality, and it's so enticing. What would that have been?
It's not just the increased resolution. I feel like there's additional smoothness to it.
Oh yeah,
It's not just the frame rate, but I think they have like more animation frames, especially like the way Wario kind of bobs up and down and his arms sway back and forth. It's not just like four frames. It's they're going smoothly back and forth, and especially in 3D, each of those arms is on a different layer. So the arm that's closer to you is really like popping in your face, and the far off arm is far. It makes Wario kind of look like a paper doll, kind of.
Something we didn't mention about the first game compared to this one is, like, technologically, it's barely holding together if you're playing Wario Land, the first one. It's just, like, the Game Boy was not designed to do this, and at times it really struggles. So when you jump from that to this, it's like a world of difference with how smooth and how, like, technically sound everything is when it's moving around on the screen.
Yeah, the Virtual Boy ran on basically the same processor as NEC's PCFX, which was a 2D graphical powerhouse. And there's even like some people think, oh, well, the PCFX sold like really horribly, so Nintendo just bought the extra processors. I don't think that's actually true, but there's a really close relationship. And, you know, that was basically pouring all of its power into rendering two sets of four shade monochromatic graphics. So it just had power to spare. It was just like, what do I do with all this extra power? And it really shows in a handful of games like this that really just, you know, make the most of it. And I love the fact that the increased size of Wario's sprite and the enemies that you face actually feeds into the element that ties it to Virtual Boy, which is that there's this plane shifting element where Wario can jump into the background. And when you jump into the background, then your sprite is more like Game Boy size, but you look tiny because there's so much more resolution. And I just love how that's handled. It's not overplayed. Like, you know, the further you get into the game, the more complicated it is to actually find the places where you find a panel that launches you into the background and figure out how to get around back there. But, you know, sometimes the background layer allows you to reach places in the foreground if you poke around right. But I love that when you jump into the background music that you're hearing actually lowers in volume, which makes you wonder, like, is the background music you're hearing all just in Wario's head? Is it just a delusion that he's hearing? I don't know, but it's one of those like goofy little details that just kind of pulls into question like the way video games work. It's just a lot of fun.
That he has like over the ear speakers in his hat, I think is what happened.
He's got one of those game hats. Yeah.
The foreground background thing too, I recall really enjoying that a lot in the Kirby Triple Deluxe game for 3DS, and to see the Wario Land pull that off like 15-16 years before that is really impressive. Like, yeah, it works. It looks to work right here. I didn't even emulate this and play it, but all the gameplay I saw was like, oh, that's really clever.
Yeah, this wasn't the game that invented the idea of like jumping between planes in 2D. Like that was a big thing with early SNK fighters, but obviously that was used in a different effect. But here, you know, it really plays up the 3D graphics element of the Virtual Boy and gives you the sensation that like, hey, I'm playing a video game, but it's in the background. I'm tiny. It's a goofy little gimmick that actually adds a lot to the game, I think. So I mentioned that there are only 10 stages in this game. There's actually 14, but four of those stages are just a boss fight. But each of the stages is very different from the others. Everyone has its own style, its own complexity, its own kind of general design. And so, you know, Bob said that it does feel a little tedious after a while because you're kind of doing the same thing over and over again. But I feel that within those levels, you're doing like the way the levels work. You are traveling through them in different ways and dealing with kind of a different sort of physical space. You have everything from like the very first stage, which is just flat out like left to right, and there's, you know, two little places you can go underground, to the Haunted Mansion, which is a really dense three-story mansion with a basement, and basically every space within the square boundaries of the level is filled. Like it's occupied by something, and there are, you know, places to jump into the background. There are rooms you can duck into that are separate from the main space. It's just, you know, every level kind of has its own vibe, and I really appreciate that. It really feels like they put a lot of thought again into the design of the stages, and even more so than the first Wario Land, there is a sense of a journey here, because the game begins with Wario, who, you know, has his own castle now and is extremely rich and just sitting around indolently drinking wine, reading a book, picking his nose, taking a nap by a lakeside. He sees something suspicious in the background, and he's like, whoa, I think I could go steal some money. And so he tries to break into someone's vault. The security system plunges him to the lowest level of the vault. And literally the game is just Wario starting at the bottom of the vault, trying to work his way back up to the surface. It's basically wizardry. But there is no world map. And when you want to backtrack, you actually have to go back through the stages, which forces you to kind of pause and say, I missed a treasure in this stage. Do I really want to go forward and try to complete the next stage and make progress in the game? Or do I want to double back here and find the treasure before I move along? Because if I move along, it's going to be kind of annoying and take a little while to get back to where I am now. So it changes your relationship with the space of the game.
Well, that also feels like kind of a weird decision for a console like the Virtual Boy, where if you're going to 100% this game, are you going to play back through, you know, the last 10 levels to get back earlier? And are you going to do that in 15-minute chunks to save your eyes and your headaches?
I think once you beat a level, you can go back to earlier levels using the elevator.
Yeah, you can, but you have to, like, when you take the elevator, it's just one level to the next. That's my experience, is you go back and it takes you to the exit of that stage, and then you have to work your way back to the beginning of the stage. So each level is
separate.
You play
from right to left.
Yeah, there's not a single elevator shaft throughout the game. It's unless I just totally misunderstood the game when I played and played completely the wrong way. But
when
you go back to a previous stage, you start at the exit.
Commenters can yell at one of us.
Yeah,
we'll find out.
If I'm stupid, that's fine.
I also really like the treasures that they choose. Like, this was in Wario Land as well. Just the randomness of them, including like a lucky cat is among them.
I got a dress was my last treasure, a frilly dress.
That's the type of humor that like you see up to the WarioWare and Rhythm Heaven games, of just like a weird random thing from real life, and it's almost just the joke is that's weird to see in a video game, huh? You wouldn't see that.
One big difference with this game in terms of how you progress through stages is that the keys that you have to find are no longer there to unlock treasure chests. They are there to unlock the next level. So it's not just enough to find the exit to the stage. You have to find a key and then carry the key to the exit. Although in this case, you don't have to basically play escort mission with the keys. Like once you grab a key, it's just part of your inventory. But you do have to find it. And then the treasure is something separate from that. And another big change here kind of relates to that. In the first Wario Land, if you can break a block, you can tell. Like it's a specially designed block. And it's obvious like, oh, Wario's going to plow into this and it's going to shatter. But that's not the case here. And this really, I think, is a big part of what informed Wario Land 2 and 3's design, where you have to smash into like everything you can. You have to butt stomp. You have to smash into the ceiling, which, you know, that can get a little tedious. But there does tend to be kind of a logic to the way things flow. And so you find yourself just like smashing into walls, trying to bust stuff up to see, like, you know, is this where the secrets are hidden? And a lot of important things are tucked away behind seemingly innocuous walls.
Yeah, the one thing I don't like as much about this game, and it's a great game, but I prefer one's approach to the treasures, because in this game, it's just like, well, it could be anywhere, like just be anywhere in this level. But in one, it was like, well, here is the door the treasure is behind, or like here is the key and the door is conceivably somewhere nearby. With this one, I would just maybe it was my own just like brain, but I was like getting anxious, like, is that the door? Is that the door? Like, where do I find this treasure? I don't want to leave.
Is it safe?
Yes, exactly.
One thing that I think does work in this game's favor is that it is only 10 levels. It does, you know, once you know how to play it, it only takes a couple of hours to play through. So if you reach the end and you don't have all the treasures, then you've got an excuse to play the game again, which is not a bad thing at all.
Going back to that haunted house level, I remember when I was playing it this time, I got to the end in, you know, 3 or 4 minutes after I thought I had explored pretty thoroughly, but I didn't have the key. And then I spent 10 or 15 minutes going back through every single room, figuring out where is this freaking key. And then it turned out it was in one of those clocks.
Yeah, there's some clock puzzles that you have to figure out.
I was like, oh my goodness, I spent so much time on this, and I didn't know whether to be disappointed in me or impressed with the game, or probably a little bit of both in the end.
So this does make some changes to the first game. Like, it pulls over the basic power set from Wario Land, but now you can actually combine powers. So if you have one hat and you pick up another hat, instead of replacing the hat, it actually upgrades it. And there's a couple of different paths to go to get basically like the ultimate power-up form, which lets you breathe fire and have the jet power and do a butt stomp. Like, you can basically, you are Super Wario. You can do everything. And kind of going along with that, you know, while the obvious breakable blocks are no longer obvious, they tend to be more hidden. This is the first Wario game that has blocks that require specific powers to break through, which is something you'd see a lot more of in Wario Land 2 and 3, which are much more puzzle-like. But you start seeing like blocks that can only be broken with the fire power up here, and there are only, you know, X number of fire power-ups in a given stage. So once you find it, you need to be careful not to lose it.
Now, I wish the bosses were a little better, though, from what I saw. I thought yeah. Wario Land had... I think they had to get too gimmicky with the bosses, I think.
Yeah, it's not a really great series for bosses. I don't think it's ever been.
Mm. I guess, well,
yeah, I feel,
you
like,
have
I feel
ultimate...
like Wario bosses get more annoying as the series goes along.
Definitely.
When your lead character is the best boss,
yeah, that's true.
Like, yeah, I guess they all look bad in comparison.
Yeah, Bob, also... you didn't make it to the final boss, but it really sucks. And maybe it's just because I was playing on CRT with basically monocular vision, but it has it's got a face that you need to punch to hit, and then it's got these two hands that are moving around, and then there's trampolines where you're jumping back and forth between foreground and background, and you're basically trying to jump into the face from one trampoline to another while avoiding the hands, and it's really difficult.
Yeah, that one does feel really different in 3D. Again, I think this is why the 3DS really needed to be the place where they redid this, and now I think that's pretty much over.
Yeah, they blew it. There was Labo VR, and now no one cares about that either.
I think stop petitioning Nintendo to release Mother 3. Let's focus on this.
Yeah.
But I will say, like, it is so easy to get up and running on a PC. It's not the, you know, full experience, but I would guess like 99% of our audience has not played this game, and it is like a 1995 Nintendo-made platformer, and there's a reason you should play it if you haven't. For whatever reason... you don't have the original hardware, that's fine, because nobody does, and very little of it is actually functioning these days unless you can solder.
My Virtual Boy has been in for repairs like 3 times in 2 years. It's ridiculous.
The last shout out I wanted to make about this game, of a cool thing I liked in watching a full playthrough of it, of all treasure playthrough of it, was on the credits, just the level of hedonism on Wario that he's on a flying carpet with his wine, and then a Playboy bunny girl, a classic like Akira Toriyama sexy bunny girl with him on it, and I was just like, wow, I'd never see Mario do this ever. And it's just
this is another one with tiered endings depending on how much treasure you found. And the weakest ending, the worst ending, all the endings affect how Wario gets back home, how he flies back home, because he crashes his plane. And the basic ending is just Wario with like two little wooden wings that he puts on his arms, and he's flapping his way back home, and birds are flying past him and laughing at him. But yeah, then you can get a plane, and then there's also the magic carpet, which I have not earned, but I feel like they really went out all out for that one.
I mean, to see again, like the PG-13 joke of the sexy bunny girl, it's very fitting for a Dragon Quest game, but seeing it in a Nintendo game felt dirtier to me for some reason.
And usually Wario's desires don't go in that direction. He's like an asexual creature.
The idea of Wario with libido, it just seems strange. It seems out of character, honestly.
he's money sexual, I think.
Yeah.
He wants money and onions and garlic. That's it.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Legend of the Mystical Ninja on Super Nintendo, where you could spend extra money to go between worlds, and all it got you was like a better mode of transportation in the cutscene.
But hey, why not?
Why not?
I like little details like that. They're stupid and pointless, and they just make the game feel a little more like, hey, someone put some thought into this for no real reason.
It's like when I was a kid getting a hidden cartoon as a reward was like better than anything I could think of.
Yeah, most old games were about playing to get like a new image. Mm-hmm. Like, here's a new picture.
Congrats, here's a JPEG.
Exactly.
And you couldn't just do an image search for best ending picture and then just see it. Yeah.
Yeah, but I really feel like Wario Land for Virtual Boy is very clearly the direct link between Wario Land and Wario Land 2. It carries so much forward from the first Wario Land game and still has that overall feel, including a much bigger, more horrible version of the tiny homunculus mohawk baby Wario when you take damage. Ugh. But
Jeremy, baby Wario.
To, like, the power-up scheme and everything. It still starts to feel more like Wario Land 2. The stages are bigger. They're more complex. They require more exploration and investigation than even the first game. You start getting into the use of powers in special ways. You know, and every stage, like I said, feels distinct. You have, basically like a forest that's one big sort of loop, and you have to kind of figure your way through that. There's a stage where there's a giant waterfall that you have to climb. There's a desert palace where you're running through the desert, and then you find this big, huge, interconnected physical space in the middle of it. There's a greenhouse with melons that you have to activate. Like, you have to like launch melons into the background in at the proper time to affect the machine. It's just a ton of secrets and interesting challenges. And the final stage really gets extremely complex, even though it doesn't look at just from a map. Like, finding your way through the main corridor, which is branches off in a bunch of different directions, is really, really challenging. And finishing that in 20 minutes is really tough. It's just a really thoughtful, interesting game. And it really is a missing link that really, really Nintendo just needs to bring it back somehow.
My final statement on this is that it has the, so Super Mario Land 3 Wario Land is a clunky title, but Virtual Boy Wario Land is probably the worst title, because if you look at the box art, it says Virtual Boy Wario Land. Virtual Boy, because it has like the logo for the system underneath it.
Yeah.
And is it called something else in Japan?
No, it was originally going to be called Wario's Treasure Hunt. And then on the back of the game, the Virtual Boy hardware box, it's like, coming soon, Wario Cruise. But then it ended up being called Virtual Boy Wario Land, I guess, because they were like, well, this is a Wario Land game.
There's
some speculation, which I don't think is true, that one of the demos that R&D1 and Nintendo showed for Virtual Boy before launch was a Mario game, like a Mario Land game, that actually uses some of the same mechanics as Virtual Boy Wario Land. But it was just like a one-stage demo starring Mario, and it played differently, and the level was totally different. So I don't think that game became Virtual Boy Wario Land. I think they were developed in parallel, and this was going to be not a Wario Land or Mario Land game. And then when that fell through, the Mario Land game did, they were like, let's just keep the Wario Land thing going. And then we got Wario Land 2 a few years later, and it's all good.
You know, the naming conventions back then, it's like, we had Donkey Kong on the Game Boy, which now everyone calls Donkey Kong 94 to avoid confusion. There was Super Mario 64. I mean, I want to be in the marketing meetings here. Like, it's on the Nintendo 64. You know, is Super Mario 64 okay with everyone? Like, yeah, it's good. We're done.
I think Virtual or Wario Virtual Land or Virtual Wario Land is better, but maybe there's some legal thing. Well, it's technically not virtual reality, but it is a Virtual Boy game, so we can call it Virtual Boy Wario Land.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the Japanese box, and it is called Virtual Boy Wario Land.
Boo.
It doesn't make me regret not getting a Virtual Boy, but it seeing this now and reflecting on it makes me wish it had been more successful, or there was some other way people could have touched it to continue this game. But
I kind of wonder if this had been the pack-in game rather than, you know, Mario's Tennis, which, you know, was kind of a fun diversion. This really showed off the hardware, and it, you know, continues the tradition of a platformer being packed in, or one of the first games, a Mario-related platformer for a Nintendo. I don't think it really would have saved the system because it had so many problems on a hardware level, but I think maybe it would have found a little more niche if this had been what they led off with.
I think I would have known at least one person with a Virtual Boy. I did not know one person. I was 13 years old when this came out. I was the perfect audience for it. Not one person in like my entire class had one of these. And somebody had a 3DO. Somebody owned a 3DO.
This system sold less than 750,000 units worldwide. So not a success. But I will say, just I was looking at the Japanese box to confirm the title, and I just noticed it has a subtitle, which is Awazon no whatever treasure is. I can't remember the word for it. Hiho, maybe, or yeah, I don't know. Anyway, Awazon, like Amazon, but the M in Amazon is upside down. Oh. So it's not the Amazon, it's the Awazon.
That's great.
I learned
to love this game a little more. That's great. I wish I had noticed that before.
And that fits more with the colonial plunderer type character that Wario was then.
It justifies his pith helmet for sure.
Oh, yeah.
He's out there with a machete and his boy Friday.
Yeah, we're running late here, or running long here, but I really miss the pith helmet, and I wish they'd bring it back. He started being too much of a Wario, evil Wario with the Wario hat.
Yeah, you know, this is my last thought on the Wario thing that I wish that I miss after playing these games. It is the antagonism with Mario. Like, it, the conversation with Mario, he just became, there's still that in, you know, sports games and Mario Kart, all that. But in Wario's own games, he basically operates like he's his own world and he's never heard of Mario. He's kind of pretending he doesn't exist. But I prefer him feeling in the shadow of Mario, and I was just reminded of it by playing a game I didn't ever play before, like through emulation, but because now it's on the Nintendo online thing. I was playing Mario's Picross 2 for the Super Famicom, and I was so happy. Like, I beat the first set of worlds puzzles, and then Wario comes in and he's like, hey, this is my game now, and he like takes over the game, and there's two separate menus of like the Mario menu and the Wario menu, where the katakana for wa replaces ma, and they're trickier puzzles with funnier outcomes. And I was like, ah, man, I love this, that it, and the pith helmet works great too. Mario is wearing a pith helmet and full explorer gear for the Picross games, because it's an archaeological game, that's how they explain it. And
That makes me think, just like Yoshi owned the first half of the 90s for Nintendo and Mario owned the second half. And then who took over? Baby Bowser? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, it was Baby Bowser. Barf.
Have we gotten through this whole thing and not talked about the Japanese pun in Wario's name?
We'll have to do that some other episode, because we are out of time. We have another episode to record. So I'm afraid people are going to just have to wonder what that could be. What is the mystery there? Oh, my God. Well, stay tuned, because 2021 is the year of Wario. Nintendo needs to accept it. They need to admit it. It's going to happen. So please look forward to more Wario episodes throughout 2021. And in the meantime, we're wrapping here for one of the last episodes of 2020. So this is a Patreon episode, therefore, like, Patreon exclusive. So we don't need to do the usual plugs at the end. I just want to say thank you for continuing to support Retronauts throughout this very rocky and difficult year. And we look forward to creating more podcasts for you in the coming year. So guys, where can our listeners find you on the internet?
I guess I'll go first.
Bob.
Okay. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. And I also have a lot of other podcasts, by the way. Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. That's our chronological exploration of the Simpsons. And with What a Cartoon, we go over a different cartoon from a different series every week. You can find those wherever you find podcasts. And Henry and I also have a Patreon of our own, patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. There's a ton of stuff there that's not available for free, like lots of miniseries. The most recent one is happening right now. It's Talking Futurama Season 2, Part 2. We're going through the back half of Futurama's second season using our trademark in-depth Talking Simpsons treatment, and that's only available behind the paywall with 100 other bonus episodes. So much going on there. If you like hearing about old stuff, perhaps you like hearing about old cartoons, and yes, Futurama is 20 years old, so yes. Suck it.
It's a ton of fun. Follow that on Twitter as well, at Talk Simpsons Pod. And you can stay in the loop about what podcasts I'm putting out with Bob on Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon if you follow me on Twitter at HENEREYG. And, you know, I tweet sometimes about playing video games, too. And it's always a great time to be on Retronauts. So thank you for having me.
Special guest Kyle, what about you?
My day job is a senior gaming editor at Ars Technica, where I write about the intersection of games and technology. You can find me on Twitter at Kyle ORL, where I talk way too much about politics these days. And my latest book is The Game Beat, where I talk about the last 15 years of game journalism and kind of meta issues of ethics and practicality. And that's published by Carnegie Mellon's ETC Press. And you can find that with Google, probably.
And finally, you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. Yes, as always. But you can also find me doing stuff with Limited Run Games. By the time this episode comes out, there will be books and other stuff that you might be able to pick up from Limited Run, purchase with cash money if you are interested. But of course, you can also check out my YouTube video chronology series that I've been running for like 6 years, 6.5 years now, that has touched on both Virtual Boy Wario Land and Wario Land 2. So you can get a leg up on our next episode by checking out the videos I've created. Just look for Jeremy Parrish on YouTube, Video Works. It's weekly, and it's tends to go too long every episode, increasingly long. Someone tell me to stop. Slow down a little, Jeremy. Anyway, Yes, thanks everyone for listening. Wow, we said a lot about Wario Land, and I wasn't sure this was even going to fill an hour, but shows what I know. Wario always leads us wrong. He always fools us.
He's gonna win.